Where'd you get those shoes? Easy. They're from DSW. Because DSW has the exact right shoes for whatever you're into right now. You know, like the sneakers that make office hours feel like happy hour. The boots that turn grocery aisles into runways. And all the styles that show off the many sides of you, from daydreamer to multitasker and everything in between. Because you do it all in really great shoes. Find a shoe for every you at your DSW store or DSW.com.
Imagine uncovering the secrets that others missed. A hidden clue, a silent witness, a twist that changes everything. I'm Carter Roy, host of Murder True Crime Stories, a Crime House original podcast. Join me every Tuesday as we dive into a famous solved or unsolved murder case. Follow and listen to Murder True Crime Stories, an Odyssey podcast in partnership with Crime House Studios. Available now on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, back on the Jeff Calkins Show. Let's do this Chris Harrington deal. Chris Harrington joins me now. Chris, what are we listening to?
So, Let Me Be Your Teddy Bear by Elvis. Among his 30 number one hits, I put that collection into the Essential Memphis Library today, as Elvis would have been 90 years old.
90 years old. Today I'll talk to you about that in a moment. Before that, a little NBA and Grizzlies. News came after I talked to you yesterday that Jimmy Butler does not want to be a Memphis Grizzly. Your thoughts?
I think there's a very good chance the feelings are mutual. I don't...
Yeah.
I feel like sort of relitigating a lot of this stuff. There's only been one piece of reporting by anyone anywhere about the Grizzlies being interested in Jimmy Butler. And that was a weird thing from a radio guy in Phoenix. And all he said was, I'm hearing the Grizzlies in Milwaukee are discussing whether to try to trade for Jimmy Butler. But that doesn't even say that they talked to Miami. Like, even if that's true, like, I'm sure the Grizzlies have had internal discussions about whether to trade for Jimmy Butler.
Right.
Like, I'd be dead certain about that. I am skeptical that in those internal discussions, they decided let's try to trade for Jimmy Butler, and they have or will try to trade for Jimmy Butler. I don't know that that's not true, but I'm skeptical that that's true. And literally, there's been not a single piece of reporting to say that that is true.
I agree. And I was not brokenhearted by the news. So you have a piece up at the Daily Memphian, multiple pieces up at the Daily Memphian, one about Elvis's album today, but one about the Grizzlies. And some of this is what we talked about yesterday, but it is interesting that not long ago, we were imagining, as we looked at what the Grizzlies had accomplished, and we were imagining that we would now get a true sense of what they really were about as they were about to embark on this stiffer schedule against Western Conference contenders. And the answer so far is we really have no greater sense, right?
No, I mean, I think the outcomes have been decent enough, good enough, you know, to get by, to feel okay about. I think there's some few specific things you could try to piece out of that, which I did. But in a broad sense of, like, establishing yourself relative to the conference, I think the results are inconclusive just because of the absences that you've had.
Yeah.
And so hopefully they start to get some guys back. I mean, there have been some pretty strong hints that John Morant and Gigi Jackson in particular may be back pretty soon. So if you just get Ja back, I mean, and Desmond Bane's day-to-day. So if you have Ja, Dez, and Jaren, like, whatever, as long as you can fill out a rotation. If you get those three guys together, you know, if not by Thursday, then maybe by the weekend, and you get to the back half of that stretch, I think it's going to be pretty interesting.
Yeah, so the news on Job was, whatever, Taylor Jenkins said soon. I think he said soon, and so who knows. Whether we'll get a doubtful game tomorrow against Houston, we shall see. But in terms of Gigi, he practiced with the Hustle. And one of the other things you wrote about was, one of the things the Grizzlies have to figure out is, what does the guard rotation look like if/when everyone is healthy or a reasonable contingent is healthy? And we really don't have much of a sense of what that would look like, right?
Well, particularly in the context of a playoff series. And so if you imagine you're healthy in a playoff series, you're obviously starting John Morant and Desmond Bane. There's some question about what you're doing at the three. Like, Jalen Wells seems to have a pretty good hold on that, but we'll see.
Yeah.
I mean, you haven't had a lot of Marcus Smart and almost no Vince Williams Jr. Maybe that will change. But in terms of, like, what are you doing, like, you know, when John Morant and Desmond Bane are out of the game, particularly when John Morant's out of the game? I mean, Scottie Pippen is the backup point guard. I don't think he has played in a way that absolutely locks himself into that role in a playoff series when the rotation shrinks. So, you know, you got Scottie Pippen, you got Marcus Smart, you've got Luke Kennard, who's played really well lately and has been a playmaker, not just a shooter. And you have the idea that, like, you know, really you're going to have Desmond Bane on the court. Like, I don't think you're going to have any playoff time where they have John Morant, Desmond Bane both on the bench.
Right.
And so if Bane's going to be your effective lead guard in the 10 minutes a game, John Morant's not playing in a playoff series, or you know, do you need a real point guard out there? I think there's a real competition for pecking order and for role among all of those perimeter players that are not John Morant and Desmond Bane. And I don't think that's been very well sorted to this point.
One of the interesting things to point out is it's not just that who's been absent that has made this difficult. It's who's the duplication of roles in people. Like, you have Santi and Gigi both out, and you've got right. Marcus Smart and Vince Williams both out, which has made it partly explained some of the recent results. But it really is sort of, I don't know, makes sorting really tricky.
Yeah, I mean, I think in some ways more the first part to me. I mean, you got a lot of season to go in the second part. But I think, you know, they're a deep team, but the lineups they've had lately, like, have been pretty – there have been times where you look up and, like, this lineup is not very athletic, it's not very big, like, there's not a lot of pop, and you're really struggling with this. And that's because, you know, a lot of your size and a lot of your physicality is out. Like, if you had done just more of a random draw of players to miss, you may have a little bit different mix there.
In terms of trying to extract meaning from these last few games, one thing we have seen is a less productive Zach Edey. This in the wake of, I mean, Drew wrote a nice piece about his Rookie of the Year candidacy. Dan Devine, over the podcast, they spent a lot of time talking about Zach Edey as a Rookie of the Year. He comes back and he has been less productive of late.
Yeah, I tend to think, I mean, he was coming off the migraine. What we thought was concussion was really a migraine. Maybe that's part of it. But I think his return from that coinciding with John Morant's absence, I think has a lot to do with it. I think, and I haven't dug into the numbers to back this up, but my sense watching games is that he's hurt by Morant's absence more than most players are. I think Morant's passing is going to get him more catch and finish opportunities around the basket than he's going to get from other players. And I think the way Morant pressures the rim weaponizes Edey's offensive rebounding in a way that no one else does. But the other part of it, I didn't mention this, but you watch the Dallas game, mm-hmm. with Morant and Bane both out, they sort of determine our offense has to be like everybody clear out and let Jaren go to work. And if you're trying to just space out around Jaren, like, that's hard for Edey to do, and that's, I think, the main reason Edey gave way to Jay Huff in that game. And so I think when you have a full complement of players, you have John Morant who can help Zach Edey more, but also if you're less reliant on Jaren to create offense, then I think that opens the door for Edey a little bit more, too.
Do you believe he's the favorite for Rookie of the Year? I mean, there's a lot of territory yet to be plowed.
I mean, if you did a vote right now, I don't know if he's the top guy on his own team. Jalen Wells has been starting all year, and that's just as good of numbers. So I'm ranking it today, not projecting forward, but today I'd probably have Jalen Wells ahead of Zach Edey. I do think there's definitely a path for Edey to win the award. If he settles into the starting lineup, Morant gets back, and he starts putting up, 14-9 or whatever on the regular, I do think there's a good chance that he emerges and wins the award, yeah.
And then finally from the piece, again, people can read it at the Daily Memphian. Chris has written about the Grizzlies and various thoughts. Early on in the season, when we were, people were obsessing about minutes, you expressed the hope and the belief that in the end, that it would be situation specific that you would see Taylor Jenkins toggle the minutes up when required. And we've seen that recently, right? Is that not, is that one of them?
Yeah, I mean, Jaren Jackson, Desmond Bane, and interestingly, Jalen Wells, have all played heavy minutes the last four or five games when they've had these absences. And so in a context where, in this case, it's not because it's playoff basketball, it's because you're so diminished by injury. In a context where, you know, you lean in to get these wins and to be more competitive, he's done that. And I always believe he would do that come playoff time, too. You know, the minutes thing has probably been over-discussed a little bit, and I've certainly discussed it a lot. But, you know, they're trying to manage a whole season and manage into the playoffs. And while they do have a belief in depth in the course of a game, a lot of it is about trying to, like, reduce workload on guys over the long haul so that you feel more comfortable giving them more later on.
All right, you assemble a, you are one of the projects you are embarked on is assembling the Essential Memphis Library, and today's entry, Elvis Presley, 30 number one hits. Tell me, what is the history of this album, by the way?
It's a compilation that RCA put out in 2002, and I'm sure it was tied to some of that. Who knows? I can't remember. They're constantly repackaging Elvis stuff to get people to buy the same things they've already bought.
Right.
Not just Elvis, but that's just sort of the way the music business works a lot of the times. But this compilation came out in 2002, and it's been pretty sticky in the sense that it was so well constructed and well conceived that it hasn't been really replaced by some similar repackaging of the exact same songs in some other configuration. Like, it's really sort of stuck. It's like, you know, if you're going to build a core Elvis collection, this is one of the places that you would start. And it is, I mean, it is what it says it is. It's his 30 number one pop hits all on one, you know, compact disc, or there's a vinyl version. I think it's probably two records or whatever. You can also, if you go on Spotify, it does exist on Spotify. Not every collection still does. And it is what it is. It goes from 1956 with Heartbreak Hotel through to, I think, 77 with Way Down. And it's the full breadth of Elvis as a pop star.
You have a sentence in there that it represents or captures or something, quote, the Elvis that the public tend to adore and rock Puritans tend to resist. Explain.
Yeah, I mean, there's part of the story of Elvis, and I think it's mostly accurate story, or to some degree an accurate story, is that he was steered in a certain direction by Tom Parker. Obviously, he did all the Hollywood crap, which really was crap, most of it. And he was steered towards, you know, a business plan that steered him away from the direction that the Sun records he did in the early 50s necessarily would have gone. And that there's a real distinction between the music he cut in Memphis with Sam Phillips and what he ended up doing later, you know, in New York and in Nashville and in California as more of a pop musician. And I think a lot of rock critics think the Sun stuff is better. And I agree, by the way, I do think the Sun stuff is better. I think it's the best music he ever made was the Sun stuff. But because of that, there's been a tendency in some quarters and over time to sort of diminish or dismiss more of the pop stuff he did later in his career. And I think in some ways that is as true to him as the other. I think at his heart, Elvis was not, even though he came up at the same time as Chuck Berry and Bo Diddley and those guys, he was a little bit different. To me, he was more of almost a Frank Sinatra, Bing Crosby type. He was an interpretive singer who just liked all kinds of music. He was not a guitarist, songwriter, pure musician in the same way.
Yeah. Interesting. Do you have any other Elvis stuff in your in the Essential Library yet? And the second question is, what is your, I don't know if you've ever ranked the best Elvis songs, but what is the best Elvis song?
So I think this is the third Elvis entry I've done so far. I did one on Elvis's Back, which is the studio album he did when he first got out of the Army in 1960, which is a pretty underrated Elvis record, I think. And I did one on the single, the Hound Dog, so sort of duplicating, but I did one on the Hound Dog Don't Be Cruel single, as, you know, an artifact of history itself, that two-sided single. There'll be other Elvis to come as the series continues. I still haven't done the Sun Sessions, you know, which we just talked about. I don't have some signature, this is the greatest Elvis song. And like I said, I like the Sun stuff best. Mystery Train, Blue Moon of Kentucky, Good Rockin' Tonight, That's All Right, all of that kind of stuff.
All right. Thank you, Chris. You can read the piece over at the Daily Memphian. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Chris Harrington from the Daily Memphian. If you are selling your house, call Josh Issa. Simple as that. If you're selling your house in 2025, 901-461-8147 and the team at Keller Williams Realty. Sometimes what you're doing is you're upgrading. And a lot of people have been like, they've been reluctant to, like, man, rates are too high. I think I'll just stay here for a little bit. And maybe 2025 is the year when you finally decide to go ahead and get the bigger home or the upgraded home that you would like. That's what James was doing. But, you know, he had the situation where you find your dream home, but you need this one to sell the one you're in. Contacted Josh Issa. They put the house on the market, and within 3 days, he had an offer that he accepted and then could go ahead and buy the dream home. That's what you want. And that's what can happen when you sign up with Josh Issa as your realtor. 901-461-8147 or the website joshhasthebuyers.com. Sam Hardiman's going to join us on the other side. It's Jeff Calkins Show, 92.9 FM ESPN. Right back on the Jeff Calkins Show, joined now by Sam Hardiman from the Daily Memphian, writes about the city. Happy New Year, Sam. Or we're not supposed to. Jeffrey, what's the date when we can't say Happy New Year anymore? Is it too late?
January 3rd, Sam, or is it 4th? It's Larry David, the Larry David rule.
Larry David has a rule.
I think it's the 4th.
I think it's the 4th as well. I've been breaking the rule all week. I do it like within the single digit days of January this is the first time I'm seeing you.
That's the key. If it's the first time, I said it to you because it's the first time we've had you on the air in 2025. So I don't apologize for it. And I also don't apologize for my Buffalo Bills losing to your New England Patriots Sunday in order to tank the Patriots draft pick. That was fun. That was a loss I really savored.
I mean, I'm glad that you enjoyed that. I did not. But it was cool to see, like, Joe Milton be competent, which was
just
fun.
Competent. Excellent.
One of the hardest throws of all time in the NFL, apparently. 61 miles per hour from Joe Milton.
He always could throw it hard. But you were, I presume, whatever depression you fell into upon the Pats' victory was lifted when Gerard Mayo was fired shortly thereafter, right?
I mean, it was almost instant. Did he walk into the tunnel? Like, I want the TikTok of like how far he walked before he was fired. I was relieved. I think we've established in my appearances on this program my NFL takes are not good. So my relief may be bad, but I was relieved because it didn't seem like a good situation for Gerard Mayo. He did not appear happy these past several weeks. Like, he did not really savor the victory on Sunday. It just seemed like he knew that something bad was about to happen to him.
Yeah. So anyway, all right. Onward we go. Since we last spoke to you, you've written a bazillion things over the Daily Memphian, but the one I wanted to focus on was the one that pertains, really, it does involve the Memphis Grizzlies, and that is the future of Beale Street. And in the piece that you wrote, that people can read over at the Daily Memphian, it published on December 31st, but it's right there. I just found it. You talk about possible management changes on Beale Street. So, just by way of background, how does Beale Street work now? Like, who runs Beale Street?
Yeah, so Beale Street, Beale Street is sort of a Byzantine structure. But what essentially it is the Downtown Memphis Commission. Okay, they are essentially the landlord. The city of Memphis owns the street, but Downtown Memphis Commission, which is this quasi-governmental board that oversees a lot of tax incentives downtown, also administers the street and is the landlord for the street, and has all these old vestigial leases that were signed back when there was a private manager of the street back in the 1980s. They still manage these legacy leases.
But just to be clear, so Silkie's is owned by the city? The properties are actually owned by the city?
That is right.
Okay.
Right. And they're then leased out to tenants. That is how that works on Beale Street.
Okay. So, and what we've seen, you reported in this story, is that was the downtown Memphis, the DMC gets a portion of revenue. And what we saw was that that amount of revenue tanked during COVID, but it's fundamentally rebounded. It feels like I'm looking at the story, 2019 before COVID, $1.6 million in rent from Beale Street, and then 2023, $1.7 million in rent from Beale Street. Why are they contemplating a new management structure, and what are we potentially looking at?
Yeah, so what I would say first is, you know, I love to talk about inflation. So, like, $1.7 million in 2023 is a lot less, actually, than $1.6 in 2019. But at the same time, it's relatively flat. And what they're talking about here, and I wouldn't say anything is necessarily wrong with Bill Street, but what is exactly going right? And I'm not trying to editorialize here. But it's more of, I think, and when you read this story and we talk to Jerome Sullivan, the former owner of Silky O'Sullivan, and you get this sense when you're talking to people, when you're on the street, that, like, it could use some renewal, okay? And so I think that is what the mayor made these comments to me, that he is investigating the changing how the management structure works on Beale Street. Maybe there's a new governing board of it. There may be, you know, that there's input from the community, you know, and the surrounding tenants, including the Memphis Grizzlies, about what this looks like. And at the same time, the mayor, because he is careful and circumspect, is not saying a whole lot here. And I would also say to people that in the short term, those of you who enjoy Beale Street, nothing that we're talking about is going to really impact your merriment, okay? And so, like, this is much more about big picture. What does Beale Street look like in the 2030s, the 2040s, the 2050s, right?
Yeah.
Because when you're talking about signing the Memphis Grizzlies to another long-term lease, you are talking about keeping an NBA team in Memphis, Tennessee, at FedEx Forum, into the 2050s. That's what we're talking about here. And so what does the area around them look like in the 2050s is really the conversation that's about to happen, I would say.
And not to mention the 2030s. I'll say it is sort of, I mean, it's pretty, from a perception perspective, once upon a time when FedEx Forum opened, it was seen as a boon, at least perceived as a boon, to have Beale Street and the entertainment district right there. And so what a great place to put a NCAA regional or a Tyson fight or whatever else. You can go right from Silky's to, and you know, now. And now there's a very different perception. Now, fair or not, like, you have this perception that people get in their cars, drive down there, park, and then get in their cars and drive home. And obviously, if the Grizzlies, and if you're Beale Street, that's not what you want. So, I guess that's me editorializing, but it's pretty clear there's a different perception. I'm going to read a quote from your story here. This is Paul Young, and the Grizzlies' involvement here, which I think is the interesting part, the most interesting part. They have definitely been an advocate for seeing the street strengthened in terms of its vibrancy and its safety, and they will be a partner and a stakeholder moving forward as we continue to explore what the future looks like. Goes on to say, I guess you asked if it's a negotiating point with the Grizzlies and the lease. He says, I don't know that the structure is necessarily relevant to the future in the city, but I think as our goal is to ensure that as we are looking at making investments in our area, which certainly helps the Grizzlies, but it's also our asset, we want to make sure that we are also looking at investments that are going to secure the long-term future of downtown, and we all understand that Beale Street is a really, really big part of that. So is there going to be, by the way, pushback from, like, let's say, I can imagine a world where people might say, Grizzlies are being bullies here, they shouldn't run Beale Street, they want to run every, that's not my view, but that I can imagine pushback. How might this start to play out? When are we going to hear more about this?
I think the ball is firmly in the mayor's court. This is sort of a decision that rests with the Memphis executive branch of government, right? And so it's firmly in his court, and I think it will play out in the way that the mayor wants to play it out. And I'm being cryptic here because, like, I don't want to get too far over my skis about how this could play out. You know, Beale Street is an important piece of Memphis's history. It's an important piece of, you know, the deep and rich heritage that this community has, right, in terms of music and, you know, the uneven pace of progress for people of color in America, and just in general, it's very, you know, it's got a lot of history with Robert Church Park right there, which others would say is an underutilized park in the city of Memphis and could use a fix up. Like it's a lot of, there are a lot of moving parts here, and I don't want to speculate on it, but what I would say, and people reading the mayor's comments, is the mayor is looking at this, looking at FedEx Forum and looking at Beale Street of like, they're both going to hopefully be here.
Right.
And how do they look the best? How do they work the best? And how do they work the best together? Right. Right. And I think that's what we're about to have a conversation about, and whether or not how that turns out is anybody's guess, and certainly not where I can speculate well.
You can read the piece over at the Daily Memphian. You and I texted about what we might talk about today, but you've written so many pieces that some have fallen through the cracks, and this one seems particularly timely. So I'll just read the headline for this piece that you wrote. Will it get cold enough for a boil advisory? Here's what the past tells us. And in the lead, you remind us, the last three winters we have had a boil water advisory. So are we going to have one? What do we need to avoid?
So far what we've avoided in Memphis is we've been below freezing most days. We've been parts of the day below freezing. We haven't been consistently below freezing, which helps. And then also we haven't had deep, deep cold. It hasn't gotten down with a single digit.
Right.
And so I had Eric Trosaeus at Memphis WeatherNet help me with this. And he pulled data, essentially, and what he said in his email back to me where he pulled it, and you read the story about how this cold snap that we're enduring, and probably going to endure for another 10 days, it looks like. My golf is really on the shelf right now. Mm-hmm. Anyway, is he pulled this data, and this is not as deep of cold as we've endured before any of these other advisors. That isn't to say that as pipes that froze begin to thaw out again, right, that there may not be issues with water pressure. And what happens to get a boil advisory simply is Memphis Light Gas and Water's water system falls between 20 pounds per square inch. So that's the pressure that's coming out of your faucet. If you go play with your faucet right now or right. Go to the bathroom and play with the faucet, if it falls below that, they have to institute a boil water advisory.
I see.
And so that's really what is going to prevent it, is how bad do the pipes break when they're thawing. And right now the weather ain't that bad. It's not that cold. You know, this is the Yankee talking here. But then also, you know, how much freezes? And that's the real question. We're not having this bone-chilling cold yet.
I got you. Okay. On the topic of MLG&W, yet another piece, this one on XAI. And Doug McGowan, yesterday, I gather it was, said there is... XAI will not soon connect to Memphis to MLG&W's distribution system, and the utility is not yet formally studying the expansion. So I'll confess, I didn't quite understand this, because to say they're not connected to the distribution system, like where is XAI, this mega factory of compute, where are they getting their power from? And isn't it some of it from the grid at this point?
Yeah, and the article does say that, Jeff, that some of this is from the grid. So I want to be clear. We're talking about two different things with XAI right now. There is a working supercomputer in Memphis, Tennessee that has 200,000 computer chips hooked up to it.
Yeah.
Okay? NVIDIA chips. It's got 200,000 of them. That is partially on the Memphis Light Gas and Water grid.
Yeah.
MLG&W will tell you 50 megawatts of power goes to it. XAI, from reporting I've done, has contracts up to 68 megawatts, okay? That's a lot of power. It's not a crazy amount of power. XAI uses about 300 megawatts of power. What XAI is doing for most of its power right now, okay, and this is according to company executives, this is also according to Doug McGowan, okay, this is the sourcing we have on this, is they use megapacks, so these are Tesla batteries, okay, that they charge, and then they're using portable natural gas generators that sit in trailers on the site. Okay, and that is what they are doing right now for this working supercomputer that if you open up your X app and type in the XAI part of it, the Grok part of it, that's literally what's going on in Memphis, Tennessee. Okay? That's what we're talking about here. The big expansion that we broke the news of at the Daily Memphian a couple of weeks ago, okay, which would grow this thing to 1 million chips. What the article about was about yesterday, and I could have been clearer, I guess, is that big expansion is very, very far away from connecting to the grid. And that expansion would probably be bringing XAI's power load to 1,000 megawatts, which might be like half of the MLG&W on a given day, okay, or close to it, all right? That is very, very far away. That's what Doug McGowan was saying to the city council yesterday. People, when they heard about this expansion, were so concerned about what it would do to the grid, because there's all this concern about what it would do to the grid. That expansion is nowhere near getting online, because literally they don't know what they don't know in order to serve it. Like, they cannot, because of federal regulations, utilities cannot just build service to a large customer without studying how it's going to impact the broader grid and if it's going to bring the grid down. Okay. And so they actually have to do these federally mandated studies every time a large power user comes online. Okay. And what Doug McGowan was saying to the city council yesterday, is, well, they haven't done that yet because it's not even that close to the pipeline.
I see.
And so I hope that helps people.
How can XAI then be proceeding if they don't know they'll have the power to run these chips?
Well, that's a great question. But as you've seen with XAI getting online very, very fast in Memphis, Tennessee, using portable generators, right, and Tesla Megapacks.
Aren't the generators problematic on their own? But
problematic is the word. I mean, they don't have proper air emissions, not proper air emissions permits. They don't have air emissions permits because they operate within a loophole in EPA regulations, okay? So they burn certain chemicals, and usually when you burn those chemicals, you have to have an air emissions permit through the Shelby County Health Department, but they've been essentially exempted for 364 days. What I would say to you is, that is maybe a ticking clock for XAI to find some long-term power generation beyond MLGW system for its current phases, the 300 megawatts that I talked about. But long-term, it is a real question, and as Doug McGowan said in the story, about the physics problem that this is, of at some point, someone may have to build a power plant to serve XAI.
You can follow Sam on Twitter or X at Sam Hardiman. There's almost too much to talk about, Sam. People should get a subscription to the Daily Memphian. So I'll just touch on this one briefly, although this one certainly is top of mind for a lot of Memphians. We had the news that that came out late last week or early this week.
when the calendar turned over, yeah.
Yeah, that there had been a decline in crime from 2023 to 2004, including homicides falling 25%. I don't think anyone is claiming victory, but you then wrote a piece that puts some of this in context, and I would urge people to read it. Among the things you learned that were interesting that you put in that story, what would you highlight?
Yeah, I would highlight is what we tried to do at the Daily Memphian is put like our crime rate in a rate perspective, so per 100,000 people, the murders per 100,000 people, and related assaults per 100,000 people. So we can look at other cities, peer cities throughout the United States. And what it's shown is, like, according to this, you know, this analysis we've done, is that Memphis's crime rate has sort of gone from, you know, the peer cities where Milwaukee and Atlanta to peer cities are now sort of Baltimore, Detroit, right, which are cities that have a usually higher crime rates. Also, what I would say is what people maybe have felt with crime, right? And the different neighborhoods feel this differently, right? There are places that don't have any crime, there are places that have a lot. But what people have maybe felt with crime is like this slow boil that over time, and really over the past 15 years, Memphis has experienced this great increase in crime, right? Like, we've had these surges in these past couple of years, but that's only because we slowly climbed to the mountaintop and are sort of maybe feeling the altitude of all the crime that's around, okay? And as an imperfect analogy, but that's what the story kind of goes over, is yes, there's been this decline from 2023 to 2024, and that's excellent. No one's rooting for violence, right? But it's because Memphis has climbed so much that the level of crime in Memphis is still very high. And so it really remains to be seen whether or not this decline is a sustainable thing, or it's just coming down from what crime is coming down from what were really unsustainable levels.
And then finally, you also explored how much we spend on public safety relative to some of the peer cities. What did you learn there?
What I learned there is, it's really interesting, right? Is Atlanta and Memphis roughly spend about $450 out of their general fund per person. So that means per Memphis resident, they're spending about $450 per person on policing, okay, each of these two cities. And Memphis and Atlanta have seen very different outcomes. It's roughly grown at the same rate over the past 15 years. I went through annual financial reports for both cities. It's roughly grown at the same rate. But Atlanta has seen growth in their population. They Atlanta is still a smaller city. The city proper, the municipality, is still smaller, much smaller than Memphis. It only has about 510,000 people. But they've grown in the past 15 years, and Memphis has declined, not precipitously in population, but since this day, we're put at about 8% in the past 15, 20 years. And so that's just really interesting that, like, these two cities are growing spending on policing, reflecting probably a community need for feel for more safety, yet are seeing very different outcomes, both in population growth and then Atlanta's crime has not grown nearly the way Memphis has. And that's interesting. I'm not drawing any sort of correlation. I'm not an academic. No. It's just very interesting.
Each one of these charts is interesting in its own right. Honestly, just the population loss is interesting because I had no idea about this. Just for example, the Memphis has lost about 53,000 people since 2005, or 8% of its population. In the same time, I would not have guessed this. Detroit declined by 42%. Now, I know Detroit
they went bankrupt, Jeff. Yes. They literally went bankrupt.
But they also now have this perception of Detroit as a city on the rise. You know, they're a comeback city. But obviously this incorporates the bankruptcy period. So Detroit declined by 42%. New Orleans, now they had a little bit of a storm down there, I believe. They declined by 20%. Baltimore declined by 11.8%. Milwaukee by 4%. And then Atlanta and Nashville both growing substantially. Nashville by 19%. Atlanta by 18.6%. Anyway, each one of these charts is fascinating in its own right, and I'd urge people to go read it and all your stuff. Sam, thank you very much, and I'll say it again, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Jeff.
Thank you, Sam. Appreciate it. Sam Hardiman from the Daily Memphian. I don't know if you saw this, Jeffrey, but Ja Morant was referenced last night on Stephen Colbert. I'll bring that up as we close when we return. It is the Jeff Calkins Show on a Wednesday, 92.9 FM ESPN. All right, back on the Jeff Calkins Show. We were talking about MLG and W, Jeffrey. I gather there's been some power outages across sort of Midtown East Memphis. The Daily Memphian offices were out of power for a little bit earlier. And I'm looking at the little outage map.
Yeah.
I'm a little worried about my own personal house right now. So we've had some power outages, just anticipation of the storm that could be coming. The Weather Channel is forecasting 5 to 8 inches of snow for Memphis. Ja Morant has been in the news a lot lately, even though he hasn't been playing basketball. He was in the news because the Wing Guru owes him money. See that?
I did see this story. From the Daily Memphian.
$365,000. I think CA had it, too. Anyway, from the owed by the Wing Guru. Seems there, like, if you owe them $365,000, you should pay them $365,000, don't you think?
Yeah.
So there you go. But then, if you were watching Stephen Colbert last night, all of a sudden, Ja is invoked because one of Stephen Colbert's writers. Well, here, let's see if this is self-explanatory. We'll play a little bit from the show last night.
Everybody, by now, we've all locked down our New Year's resolutions. Well, I've got a particularly wild one here at the show from one of my writers. His name is Asher Perlman. That's Asher right now. In fact, let's bring Asher out. Come on out. This is Asher Perlman. One of my writers. Asher, good to see you.
Hey, good to see you.
Have a seat. There you go. Here's the deal. I found out about a New Year's resolution that you had. You're a big basketball fan?
Love basketball, yeah.
Okay, yeah. Okay, so I heard you were taken by one very particular dunk from Ja Morant of the Memphis Grizzlies. Let's take a look at the dunk that you saw in December.
Okay.
Morant, ball fake.
Oh! Shout out Pete.
Pete Pranica making his Colbert debut.
Okay, that was pretty impressive.
That was
okay?
Great, yeah.
Because he's going up, gets blocked. Brings his arms down while his body continues to go up and then jams it behind his
head. And
there's
a 7-foot man in front of him
trying to stop that
from
happening.
Stop him, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's called a double clutch dunk in midair with a two-handed reverse finish. That's what I understand.
I believe you.
Now, after seeing this dunk, and this is all true, is why we're doing this, you sent your friends this text. The specific way in which I'm crazy is that I think I could do that if you gave me 6 months.
I good luck
now
with that.
That, I think we can all agree, is stark, staring madness. Why do you think you could do that?
Well, I don't think I can now, but I think in six months...
Yeah, just
the work in. If I put the work in, I think I can do it in 6 months.
You honestly think in 6 months you could do that? How old are you?
I'm 38 years old.
And in 6 months?
39.
Okay. All right. How are the knees?
Younger than LeBron.
Like injury bad?
Really bad. I mean, I can't jog anymore.
There's no jogging in basketball, so you're fine.
No, it's just a quick sprint.
So just the knees.
Knees are bad, and I had shoulder surgery recently, so I'm still working up.
That's jaw-esque.
Yeah.
Well, that's full mobility.
Okay, same model.
Yeah.
Aside from the joints of your body,
right.
You're quite tall, and you're a writer for me, but you're quite tall. I assume when you're not writing for me, you're playing basketball all the time.
Actually, I'm a cartoonist.
You got a book called Well, This Is Me.
Yep.
There you go.
That's my book.
Okay, that's very impressive. It will not help with this. Tell me about you. Let's talk about your bat. You played any basketball?
When I was younger, I played in an intramural league.
And we have a photo here. There you are. Pick yourself out of that. Pick yourself out of there.
There I am.
That's you. Yeah. Almost the tallest person over there. Yeah. And this is your high school team?
This is, well, I was homeschooled. So.
Oh.
So you were homeschooled?
I was homeschooled.
So are you from like fundamentalist Christian background?
No, like lefty Jews.
It's all kinds of homeschools.
The schools were not lefty enough for your parents.
Not quite,
okay,
not quite.
So how did you have a team?
Well, they're all homeschoolers, and
the whole homeschool
we put
team.
Together a team and joined an intramural league. That it was us, and then varsity basketball teams on their off season.
And they were using you as sparring partners?
Mm-hmm. I guess you never
they
thought
would
you
slap
could
you around.
Basically, yeah,
never.
Well, we lost
That's one
every
of the blessings,
game.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely. Never had to consider it.
Okay. You that still is. Think you could do this, though?
Pete Pranica makes this, Stephen Colbert. I suspect they will check back in with him. I think this is going to be a see how he's progressing. I didn't listen enough to know if he actually has dunked ever before in his life. But I suspect they'll check back in with him. And you notice, it's not a Shea Gilgeous-Alexander dunk. It's not a Donovan Mitchell dunk. It's not a LeBron dunk. It isn't a. I mean, we saw some spectacular. We saw a Cooper Flagg dunk last
yes,
night.
Yes, that was a phenomenal,
phenomenal dunk. But of all the dunks to be highlighted on Colbert, it is a John Morant dunk, and that is available to you at FedEx Forum most nights. Some nights when the Grizzlies play. That's how lucky we are. So there you go. Highlighted once again, making the national news on Stephen Colbert. What is coming up next on 92.9?
Jeff, here's what's coming up next on Jason and John. Joe Theismann will join them at 11:25. Norton Hurd will join them at 1:25. Cerrito with me today. CJ Hurt will join us. Cobb with Gabe at 5 o'clock.
Thanks for listening, everybody. We will be back tomorrow. Stay warm. For now, work is done.